It seems like nowadays every action movie has a weapons room scene. You know where the hero goes to gear up for war? They enter a room and they open a secret panel in the wall or under the floor and voila, there's a cache of weapons ready for any fight. And you know the scene, you guys especially, I can tell you, every guy in here can think of a movie where that scene has been shown. And you know, maybe you're the kind of guy that was kind of drooling over those weapons. I don't think any of the women here were. Maybe, probably not. The guys probably were just really excited about that scene where they see all those guns and hand grenades and maybe even rocket launchers and all the other stuff that are necessary for a real serious fight. Well, in our studies of 1 Peter, we've entered God's spiritual weapon room. God's weapon room. And so far in our study, we've seen three great weapons that are available to followers of Christ. And these weapons are more powerful than anything we see in any of the movies. They are unique and incomparable. Nothing on earth matches them. Instead of cold steel, gunpowder, and lead, we have living weapons. In chapter 1, verse 3, we saw the living hope of salvation through Jesus Christ. No weapon in the world can even come close to replicating the power of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But there were more. In chapter 1, verses 23 through 25, we found the living word, which has an unlimited power to transform the lives of those who will consume it. It has the power to take lives that are messed up and destroyed and rebuild them and remake them into something new, something that is pleasing to God. Then in chapter 2 and verse 4, we saw the living stone, which is an immovable foundation to build our lives on so that we can stand strong as a special people of God. These are our weapons. These are the weapons of the believer that we have them, we have access to them, and they are far better than anything in any human arsenal because they lead to eternity with God. Man's weapons are designed to destroy. Blow things up. God's are designed to redeem and to rebuild lives that have been broken and destroyed by sin. So when we think about these things, the living hope, the living word, and the living stone, do we think of them as weapons and look at them with the same kind of desire that we might have for the kind of weapons we see in the movies? Do we do that? Do we look at them in that light with that same kind of desire or longing for them? Remember I said, guys will drool over those guns in those movies. Do we drool over these weapons that we have from God? I would hope so. I would hope so. And that's one of the things that we're trying to accomplish by this study of 1 Peter is to get us to appreciate the things that God has done for us. So having been through the armory and loaded up with the powerful weapons of God, tonight we're going to kind of start the implementation phase of our study. As Peter begins describing and explaining how to use those weapons in our daily warfare against Satan and sin. Because what Peter is saying here in his letter is that we are at war. We are going to battle against Satan and the forces of evil. And these are the things that we need to go into that battle with so that we can have victory, so that we can succeed, win over this. It's a daily warfare against Satan and sin, and it's an internal and external warfare. It begins with the war against the soul. Look in chapter 2 and verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. They wage war against us, so there's an internal battle. And then in verse 12, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the things in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So you have the external enemy, and then you have the internal enemy, our self, our fleshly self that tries to pursue things of this world. And then this ends there in chapter 5 of 1 Peter, flip over to chapter 5, with the effort of Satan, kind of like a final last gasp, or last warning here, Satan's going to come after you, be ready to fight. Verses 8 and 9 of chapter 5, 1 Peter, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. And so we start off with this idea of battling against this fleshly lusts, and ending with Satan is going to try to destroy you. Satan is going to try to eat you up. And we'll talk about that a little bit tonight, and then especially though when we get to that text later on in our studies. Now, let's back up to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. And this section here, we're going to break this broad section of chapter 2, 11 through chapter 5, 10, verse 9. And we're going to look at a smaller section of it. And of course, as you know, then we're going to look at a smaller section of that, because we have a number of things here in the Bible. We have we're facing a war, facing a world that wants to conquer us, and so we have to look at it as sojourners. So we have to be ready for battle as sojourners on this earth, and we're doing this in front of a watching world. We have to be ready for battle as citizens in the kingdom, kingdoms of this world, as well as in the kingdom of God, and as servants. And as spouses. And those are the four things that we'll be covering in the next few lessons. And we'll look at sojourners tonight here back in 1 Peter 2, verses 11 and 12. And that's what we're going to look at. Let's read the text again, 1 Peter 2, verses 11 and 12. Behold, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now let's talk a little bit about this idea of sojourners. And we spent some time already looking at this, going back to chapter 1, and in verse 1, he says, to those who reside as aliens, and it's the same word there in chapter 1, verse 1, as we see here in 2:11. The idea of aliens or sojourners, as the some versions say, read, and it's the idea of someone who lives in a land that is not their home. Their home, not their own. It's a pilgrim or an immigrant, and it's the idea of, and as we see it in the news today, as people who are coming to this country or go to another country that is not their home. And what he's saying is here that Christians are aliens. We live in a world that is not our home. And he says, he adds to the text here in verse 11, the idea of pilgrims, which is a short-term idea of a tourist. So you have the idea of a pilgrim or an alien who comes and immigrates in and wants to live there. And then the tourist or the pilgrim is somebody who comes by and goes on a visit and travels through, but knows that it's not their home. Both their ideas, both words are describing the idea of us recognizing this world is not our home. We don't live here permanently. Now, I think I mentioned before about the idea, you know, buy your permanent, your forever home. No, any home on earth is not our forever home. Now, we may live in it all of our lives, but eventually we're going to leave that home behind. It will not go with us, and we will not stay there forever. In fact, it's interesting, you go back into Genesis 23, verse 4. I've got it on the PowerPoint, so you don't have to spend time looking back there. But Genesis 23 and verse 4, when Sarah died, Abraham had to buy land to bury her. It says in verse 4, then Abraham rose from before his dead, that's Sarah, and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. But here's the thing. Abraham had been living there 60 years in the area, and in that area for many decades. He'd been there for a long time as far as we're concerned, but Abraham recognized that he's just a stranger. He's just a sojourner. He's just a part-time liver in this area in a place that is not his own. And that's because Abraham wasn't focused on the physical land. He was focused on a spiritual dwelling. He wasn't really concerned about how long he was living on this earth, because he knew eventually he would leave. And that's why Hebrews writer says, it was mentioned in class this morning, by faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, where he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So he was looking ahead to eternity, to a home with God. That's why he's a sojourner. He was not a person who was trapped in the idea of living here in this world. He knew it was not going to be his, even though he lived twice as long as most of us would even think about living. He knew that it was not his forever home. His focus was on the temporal land, or not on the temporal land, but the eternal land. And what we are going to learn as we work through this is that we must have that same focus. We must have that same focus to win the war against the fleshly lusts that seek to destroy our souls. What the world wants to do and what our lust wanted, what the Satan wants to happen to us, is for us to get so occupied with the things that we desire, the fleshly things that we desire. Typically here, primarily the idea of immorality is the idea in the text, but it could be any kind of fleshly desire, not just flesh, sexual. And what that means then is that we have to learn to live in this world knowing it isn't our home. And we get attached to our homes, don't we? We work on them, we rebuild them, we repaint them. Well, guys, if you're married, you know that at some point your wife's going to come to you and say, we need to paint this. We need, you know, they're always wanting to change something. A guy's like, okay, well, if it hadn't fallen down, it's fine. Lady just looks at it and says, that needs to be a different color. I agree. You learn, guys, just learn to say that. You're right, honey. It needs to be painted. Now, if I would just learn that, then life would be a lot better. All right. We can't let the things of this world capture our hearts and minds. So we're going to point out three things from the text here. First thing is stand back from fleshly lusts. And there in verse 11, the first part of that verse, it says, the second part of the verse in verse 11 is, abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. So we have to look at it as strangers and sojourners. We live as strangers and sojourners. Then we have to stand back from fleshly lusts. And abstain just means to refrain, to stay back or away from something that we consider dangerous. Anybody here ever gone to the Grand Canyon? Okay. All right. Did you walk out? All right. Is anybody like me? Guess what I said? And comes up and stands on the edge and does that? Anybody? Okay. Well, I guess I'm kind of unique maybe that way. All right. Well. I have an unhealthy unfear of heights. Well, so you do that or you go to the Empire State Building, and you're not going to step out over it because we know we're not the Roadrunner. You know in the Roadrunner cartoons, Wile E. Coyote? You know, Wile E. Coyote gets out there and he runs off the edge and he gets out there and stops and looks around, looks down, and all of a sudden, as soon as he looks down and realizes he's standing on nothing, he falls. Roadrunner gets out there, stands there, looks around, turns around, and goes back the other way. That's cartoon. That's cartoon logic. It doesn't deal in reality. And so we know that there's a danger of falling from high spaces. Those places have warning signs. Stay back to keep us away from the edge. If we get too close, we could slip off and fall. I think I saw a video the other day of somebody who was on an edge of a really dangerous place and slid off. Another way of describing it is being careful with fire. Anybody ever gotten burned playing with fire? My wife's uncle was not playing with fire, but he was burning some brush in his yard one day, and he had a can of gas, and he threw the gas onto the fire to get it going faster, and it raced right back up that stream up his arm and rushed it, sent him to the hospital with severe burns. And he had to wear a sleeve on his arm for a long time because of the severity of the burns and the scarring that was the result of that. And so we're taught to stay away from these things. And that's what Paul is doing. He's urging us to stay back from the strong desire for sexual immorality and the things of the flesh. They are a dangerous enemy. They are as dangerous as fire. They will burn us and leave scars as bad as any physical fire. In chapter 4, in verse 2, he says we should no longer live in the fleshly lust, but abstain, but instead live for the will of God. Verse 2, so as to live, we're to follow the example of Christ, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. So we're to live for God instead of the things of this world. Now, thinking of this in the context of sojourners, one of our problems is that we want to blend in or fit in with the native people around us. We don't want to stand out. We want to look like everybody else. And that's okay when it comes to clothes, as long as they're decent and language, as long as it's decent. You know, we don't. If you ever traveled to a foreign country like the England, Bob with England recently, and so did Terry and Becky. I had to go through the name, the list, the alphabet to get to the names there. They went as well, and they were a different country. But when you were over there, did you wear a sign? I'm an American tourist. Look at me. Look at me. No, you wear clothes that kind of blend in to the degree you can. You try to speak the language. In England, it's easy. Sort of. If you open your mouth, they'll realize you're not from there. Especially, you know, me being from Texas. When I was in England, it was obvious. You know, I'm talking like this, and everybody's giving me that look because they know I'm not from that country. Well, anyway, we don't want to blend in with the world. And this is a problem, especially for young people. To keep up at all with the news and what's going on in the world today, there is an overwhelming effort by the world to consume young people and get them caught up in this ridiculous pursuit of sexual immorality. Where do you and so now, 25% of young people, supposedly according to some surveys, are claiming to be gender neutral or claiming to be gay because they're gay interested, because it's being promoted as the thing to do, and so they want to blend in, and they want to act like the people that are around them. And don't think for a moment that it's not going on here in Litchfield. Social media is everywhere. There's not a bubble around Litchfield that keeps it out. And so it's going on here. And your kids are going to have to, especially as you got teenagers or almost teens, it's going to be a problem for them. And you need to be aware of that and prepare to battle that with all your might. Because the world's going to, because they're going to reach a point where they're going to say, Mom and Dad are no longer cool. All my buddies who are cool. And, half of them think they're gay, so I need to think I'm gay. It's something you have to be prepared for and fight against. Do you hear me? Are you listening? Don't pretend it's not something that will hit your household. It can very easily. And it's not just teenagers and young people. It's old hipsters. Want to think we're still hip, and so we want to act like we're young or act like the world around us and want to blend in. So that's a struggle, a problem for every generation. But there are some customs, some ways of thinking that we simply must not learn because they serve the flesh. And the fleshly lust. So while we're here on earth, we're going to pick up some customs of the world around us. That's inevitable. But we must learn not to participate in the ones that war against the soul. Stay away from them by standing out instead of fitting in or blending in. Be willing to be the weirdo. You hear me again? Be willing to be that person that says, I'm not going to talk that way. I'm not going to go see that. I'm not going to consume that. I'm not going to be engaged in that. I'm simply not going to do it. Because in a sense, and I'll tell you another thing that's really bothering me is that there's the part of what's going on in society right now is what I've recently been calling the compassion trap. The compassion trap is this. Somebody's involved in some kind of sin and they've messed up their lives, but I feel so sorry for them that rather than trying to get them to stop it and turn their life around and go in the other direction and fix it, I just embrace them in love and sympathy and compassion. This last week I heard a better description, a better phrase, suicidal sympathy. Suicidal sympathy says that the world that these folks that are pursuing all these fleshly lusts and are destroying their lives, we have to have sympathy for them even when they destroy our very culture and everything around us. And I think not only is it suicidal, it's sadistic. It's sadistic to say to someone who is a drug addict, oh, I feel so sorry for you. I'm sorry that these drugs are destroying your life. Here's a clean needle. so that you don't get some kind of disease. Oh, kill yourself with a drug, but don't get a disease from the dirty needle. That's sadistic. That's cruel. That's not godly. That's not loving. But we've got brethren that are just spewing this stuff out of this suicidal, sadistic sympathy. We have to be aware of that. We must stay away from that. Because Satan, well, let me back up, warfare has one goal. When you go to war, when a country goes to war, it has one goal, conquest, victory. And it uses two tactics. Break things and kill people. That's what an army does. That's what the Air Force does. Its job is to break things and kill people, or be so good at it that nobody wants to pick a fight with you because they don't want you breaking the things and killing their people. Satan has one goal. Conquest. Victory over your soul and the soul of every single human being. And he will happily break everything in your life, including your soul, and destroy you, kill you, to do it. He doesn't offer these things, these fleshly lusts, out of a desire to make you happy. That's not what his purpose is. Paul describes the power of the flesh as a force that is almost personal in its effort to capture us. In Romans chapter 7, verses 22 and 23 says this, I delight in the law of God after the inward man, so there's a part of me on the inside that wants to do what God says. But I see a different law in my members, that's just another part of himself, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity under the law of sin which is in my members. So it's almost like it has person. It's not a real person, but it's so powerful. The desires and the fleshly lusts are so powerful, it's as almost as if they have real personhood and identity, personal identity. That's the goal. That's the desire, to destroy us. We must not let it succeed. And this is our daily internal battle against the power of the flesh. They're far more dangerous than the cliff of the Grand Canyon or the falling off the Empire State Building or the edge of the fire pit. Because, and that's probably fire pit's a better description because, well, except for me, everybody else is smart enough to know that it's not smart to get on the edge of the cliff. But a fire pit, all of us stand around a fire pit and maybe get a stick and poke and get a little too close to the fire poking around in it because we think we're in control. Not necessarily. Stay away in order to live and not be harmed or damaged. Well, stand back from lust. The last thing is stand out in daily living, and that's verse 12. Let's go back to 1 Peter 2, verse 12. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good works, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. And this gets to the why. Because it's a higher purpose than not just harming ourselves or anybody else. It's about not plunging, it's more than just about not plunging to death or getting burned up. It's about setting the right example for the watching world because the world is watching us. The world is watching us and we're watching the world and too often trying to become like the world. And what we need to be doing is we need to be showing the world, all right, you want to know how to live? You don't do drugs. You don't have immoral. You don't sleep around. You go to work. Keep your nose clean. And you serve God. You do the will of God. You do those things and you're probably going to have a decently well-lived life. You do those things. You do the opposite of that. You're going to have a messed up life. And we need to show the world that not only do we not do those things, we don't encourage anybody else to do those as well. We live in an honorable manner in front of the world so that they will see that we live by a living hope and a living word and a living stone. We have those living things in our lives. And so that what happens is that when we're accused of being evil people, and we will be accused of being evil people right now, and in the homosexual community, they require two. You talk about binary. They say non-binary. Well, they're binary in this respect. You either love them and accept them, or you hate them. They will not accept a middle road of, I love you, but I'm not going to accept what you do and approve of it. If you won't agree to approve of it, then you're a hater. And so we will be accused of that. And what we have to demonstrate by our lives and the way we talk to and about people is that we love them. We don't make fun of people, their problems. We don't joke about the things that happen to people because of sin. We don't find those things funny. We're not sadistic. We are compassionate people. But we're not suicidal either. We know and recognize these things have consequences and we point them out. We must live in a way that demonstrates the transformative power of the living Word of God at work in our heart, showing that we live by hope. And Peter was writing people that were going to be accused of horrible things. They're going to be accused of incest. They're going to be accused of eating people, drinking blood, being atheists, unbelievers. They're going to be accused, and then they're going to be killed, arrested, their property taken away from them, and their lives frequently taken. But imagine that in some places, in fact, you don't have to imagine. I don't have a copy of this, but I've read quotes of histories of the early martyrs where guards and people that were involved in executing Christians because of their faith were converted to Christ and surrendered to be killed themselves because of the behavior of the person they were killing. Now, can you imagine that? The temptation would be, maybe God will forgive me, but I'm not going to die. Their behavior changed people's hearts and minds. So think about it. If you were being accused of being a Christian, the first thing would be, would there be enough evidence to prove you to convict you? Secondly would be that if you're brought into court and you're accused of you're doing all these awful things as a Christian, and then somebody, your neighbor coming in who's not a Christian is saying, well, wait a minute, I know him, I know her. That's a lie. This person is a good person. They would never do those kind of things that they're being accused of. That's the kind of life we have to live before the world because it is watching us. And they will slander us. We'll talk about that in a later lesson. They'll slander us just because they hate us. But we want to make sure they have no evidence to prove what they're accusing us of. Instead, have evidence that we're good people. And then there will be people who will see it and be ashamed. So, you know, you're right. You're not that way. You're a good person, and I want to know what it is that you believe in so I can have that peace and that hope and that stability that you have. Hope that shines in your heart because of the living Word that has transformed your life and built it on that living stone that'll stand forever. Those are our weapons. This is our, chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 10. Those are our weapons. This is who we are. Now we're going to be talking about how we live that out every day in battle against the world which wants to destroy us. Do we realize that the world is watching? I hope so. And if we realize that, what do they see? Do they see sojourners standing out by faith in God? Is that what they see? I hope that's what they see. If not, can we help you do something about that? Help you become the kind of person that when the world sees you, if they hate you, it's because you're the good person and you're a godly person, not because you're evil or wicked. We can help you be right with God tonight, whether it's to be baptized or whether it's to repent and return to God for the first or because of sin in your life that you need to make right. Or if you just need encouragement to fight the battle and get help putting these weapons together so that you can go out and go into battle and win. Let us help you do that tonight while we stand.